historical example of Thomas Pewick's work on birds. But happily, I think it does follow very well from the papers we've already had, in that it deals with the limits of the knowable. The wood engraver Thomas Pewick produced his History of British Birds at the end of the 18th century. The first part on land birds appeared in 1797, and the second part on water birds followed in 1804. Here is the title page with the scribbles on it are actually of John Ruskin's. This is John Ruskin's copy of the book. Almost from the moment of its appearance, Bewick's book was hailed as offering far truer, more lifelike images of the various bird species than any of his predecessors had achieved. Here, I'm sure you know, is a spotted flycatcher. You see the sort of streaking of the head and the slight spotting of the breast. William Howitt, in a book on the rural life of England, claimed that whichever bird Bewick was depicting, it could be recognised immediately. Quote, "Its genuine characteristics are all about it. There it is in the very scenery that you see it surrounded by in nature." This satisfying impression of verisimilitude involved a high degree of artistry. There's nothing simple about it, although people often imagine that natural history drawing is a fairly prosaic form of art. Bewick worked from his watercolour drawings, tracing the distinctive contour of the bird onto the wood block, and then devising lines and marks that would suggest the patterns and the tones of the plumage, beautifully harmonised with its environment. Here is one of a starling, of course. These visual portraits of birds were far more important than the text was in representing the distinguishing features of each species and recreating its whole look and ambience in nature. A century earlier, Locke, in his essay concerning human understanding, had established the key importance of visual images in epistemology. Locke acknowledged that pictures, like words, were necessarily conceptual, but they were apparently a shade less arbitrary than verbal language in their relation to external phenomena. Someone consulting a natural history book would, Locke thought, gain, quote, "a clearer idea of apium or ibex from a little print than he could have from a long definition of the names of either of them." Oliver Goldsmith, at the end of his multi-volume History of the Earth and Animated Nature, 1774, which Bewick read, expressed similar ideas in a less philosophical spirit. "Wise people study, quote, nature as she presents herself, storing their minds with effects, rather than trying to delve into hidden and disputed causes. We should be, quote, content with the history of appearances, concerning which all mankind have but one opinion." In the state of knowledge that existed in Bewick's day, with its confused nomenclature, doubtful identifications of species, and disputed taxonomic systems, a convincing visual image could represent a point of reference, a kind of truth on which to build a definition. But convincing records of appearances are only part of Bewick's appeal to his public. The layout of his book has an orderliness and an aesthetic perfectionism that encapsulates his view of the natural world. There is a detached article on each species, in this case of course it's the turnstone, this is a hand-coloured copy, with an engraved figure of the male bird forming a headpiece and a little tailpiece balancing it on the opposite page. Here is a lovely moonlight view of the coast. A kind of essentialism or reductionism that ignores, if it does not deny, the mysterious and complex connections between life forms. One could relate this sense of visual order to the classical episteme which Foucault described in Les Mots et les Choses, the order of things, as characteristic of the period. But Bewick did not wish to systematize nature, as Foucault might have imagined. Bewick described the taxonomic systems invented by his contemporaries as being, quote, like skeletons injudiciously put together. His purpose was religious rather than scientific. As he explained in British Birds, he wished to reveal the beauty of God's creation. Nature was a reflection of the character of the Creator himself, and animals were, quote, the visible words of God. Like the teaching of Christ, nature seemed to represent to him quote, a mathematical point, a point of perfection for all men to aim at. And the beauty of birds in particular expressed this perfection, as indeed did the design of his pages. But this beauty had a purpose which was also part of the divine providence. The symmetry and elegance discoverable in their outward appearance, the outward appearance of birds, Buick writes, although highly pleasing to the sight, are yet of much greater importance when considered with respect to their peculiar habits and modes of living, for example, in protective camouflage, he's thinking. Animals were adapted to their destined place in the natural world through the benevolence of their maker. It followed that the birds which God had designed should be drawn with the greatest possible fidelity, so that the divine nature could shine through as though through clear glass. But accurate drawing was an act of faith in more senses than one. We may see God's individual artifacts clearly, but we cannot discern the whole plan. This can be made out only faintly and mistily, as though through a glass darkly. Thus the impression of certitude and lucidity, which one gains from leafing through British birds, is delusive. The polymorphism of many bird species, according to sex, age and season of the year, even regional variations in plumage, in many cases defeated his best efforts at identification. Buick often represented female or young birds under the impression that they were the adult males of distinct species. There were many other confusions that only a reference to Buick's drawings by present-day ornithologists can elucidate. His illustrations, apparently so lifelike, were often composites. He might draw an outline from a bird glimpsed in the travelling menagerie, a live bird, as in the case of his eagle owl, and then fill in the details of plumage from a badly stuffed specimen or from an illustration in an earlier book. Of course, we're looking at the bittern there, a wonderful example of all this striping and mottling and spotting which Buick loved. And of course, the way he expresses this assimilation into the environment through this ravishing pattern of the undergrowth and the reeds round the bird. The unnatural poses given to the birds by 18th century taxidermists had to be modified on the basis of rare sightings of their living counterparts, or on the basis of pure guesswork or analogy. And the birds were then reinserted in an imagined setting from which they had actually long been divorced. There was no way of knowing whether the available specimen was typical of its kind, or how one could define the typical, or indeed whether it could be said to exist. There was not even any definitive way of describing what one saw. Buick was frustrated by the imprecise and severely limited terminology of colours that was available to him. For example, he had to use the word yellow to describe both a golden oriole and a barn owl. He suggested the adoption of a recognised vocabulary, such as was provided by Werner's Nomenclature of Colours. This is a page from it. This is actually Charles Darwin's copy, which he took with him on the voyage of the Beagle. This became a standard tool for 19th century naturalists, but wasn't in general use in Buick's time. It's a fascinating work in that it gives names to colours on the basis of comparisons with the hues of animals, vegetables and minerals. You can read across, you see. Agreed human definitions thus rely on a gathering of sensory data from the natural world itself, in an attempt to overcome the arbitrariness of words and ideas which Locke had discerned. Here, pale canary bird, wings of goldfinch, and tail coverts of golden pheasant act as touchstones in the naming of different yellows as you go down the page. The epistemological problems were greater when one was representing a bird of an unknown species. Here is a garden warbler. Buick drew one of the most observant likenesses of a garden warbler that exists, and it served as a model for the illustrations in field guides down to the 20th century, so I'm told. Yet he did not know what species it was, and had never watched it alive. The visual image is then detached from any other form of cognition. Even for a firm believer in natural theology, as Buick professed to be, problems of ontology and representing the natural world must have been shaking and disconcerting. To quote Foucault again, perhaps not quite in the sense that he intended, Late 18th century naturalists were forced to recognise that, quote, the visible order with its permanent grid of distinctions is now only a superficial glitter above an abyss. In British Birds, Buick identified his approach to the study of nature with that of the Reverend Gilbert White, author of The Natural History of Selborne, one of those books that's never been out of print since it was first published. And the two men were often compared, Buick and Gilbert White. Selborne epitomised the empiricism of the natural theologian, who humbly studied the workings of nature as manifestations, so he believed, of the loving wisdom and providence of God. For Buick, too, the nature of bird species could only be apprehended in the round, so to say, by an observer who penetrated their natural surroundings. One should learn the unique distinguishing characters of birds, he says, by watching them in flight or at rest. Quote, the notes, or as it may with propriety be called, the language of birds, whereby they express their various passions, wants and feelings, could also be recognised through first-hand experience. In practice, however, Buick's presentation of birds, like that of other contemporary naturalists, was fragmentary and incomplete. Their portrayal involved a process of synthesis of disparate data, an exercise of imagination and a high degree of artifice. This process of assembly was reversed by many of his readers, which I found quite fascinating. The engravings from British Birds were often cut out of the book or printed on separate sheets of paper to be stuck in albums or used to extra illustrate other books, or interleave with the buyer's own notes and an array of other imagery, so they changed their identity in a new context. In these ways they could be co-opted into other systems of classification, absorbed into other patterns of knowledge, which might be as idiosyncratic as Buick's own, a process of disassembly and reassembly of parts which belies the holistic ideal of the religiously minded naturalist. One particularly interesting example of this is a set of albums compiled by various members of the Fawkes family, the Farnley Hall in Yorkshire, from about 1810 onwards. Buick's wood engravings were snipped out of copies of British Birds and stuck down on the pages of the albums as a sort of index of species. They appear on the brown paper on the left-hand side of each opening of these albums. There they were accompanied by the actual feathers of the birds in question, which of course had been shot by members of the Fawkes family, taken from fresh specimens shot in the field. Each feather is labelled meticulously as to the part of the bird from which it is taken. There are, besides, some exquisite watercolours by J.M.W. Turner, you know, the great artist Turner, who was a friend of Walter Fawkes, as indeed Fawkes was also a friend and correspondent of Buick, and by various gifted amateurs, friends of the Fawkes family, working under Turner's influence. Here's another opening, sorry, I should have said, this is the jay, and of course these wonderful feathers of the jay on the right-hand side. Some of these watercolours, this one is by Turner, of a wood pigeon, some show the birds as though alive, others show them as limp bodies, as in this case. They're full of the pathos of recent death rather than the artificial animation that might have been given to them by taxidermy. The birds are killed and then they are reconstituted through the bringing together of engraved and painted images and actual body parts. Even the leg of a stilt and the beak of a spoonbill are stuck into these albums. The exercise is both scientific and voluptuous. The present owner of the albums told me that as a boy he used to stroke the feathers, which are still soft and rich in colour. John Miller, in his recent book on Empire and the Animal Body, describes the dioramas popular in the late 19th and early 20th centuries as a conjuring trick. They effect what he calls a transubstantiation of animal remains. The skins and horns of the massacred animals are used to bring them magically back to life, or rather they are invested with a different kind of life as expressions of human possession, ordering and control. It could be argued that such enterprises as the compilation of the Fawkes albums were the fruits of an arrogant anthropocentrism, as distant from present-day Western sensibilities concerning ecology as they are from the present state of ornithological research. think there's one more I haven't shown you actually. There's a nice chaffinch from these albums. But I would say that even with the full battery of binoculars and telescopes, cameras, sound recordings, population surveys, habitat analyses, aerial mapping, ringing and electronic tagging, we are still far from any true knowledge of the richness and complexity of a bird's existence and experience, and of the diversity of character, even between individual birds of a given species. New epistemological fields, or a priori patterns of thought, have simply replaced those that inform Bewick's British Birds. Thank you.